making TV special.
Yes. Made with creamy butter. Yeah.
And you know what that means?
It's happening. I can feel it.
Yep.
Has the traction magnets on the run. Who likes to smoke, enjoys a joke, and wouldn't get a bit upset if he were really broke. With wealth and fame, he's still the same. I'll bet you five you're not alive if you don't know his name.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the B-side episode of 167 for Media Monarchy. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com. And it's Saturday, April 24th, and it's a very bachelor weekend for me, recording from my apartment in downtown Portland, Oregon. We just started off with The Union Forever from the White Stripes' July 2001 album White Blood Cells. Just one of the things that I dig about the White Stripes, and that song in particular, so many references to Orson Welles, whether they're singing about Rita Hayworth or, like, in that song, pretty much every line is from Citizen Kane. And I did just watch It Might Get Loud, the documentary from the director of An Inconvenient Truth. It Might Get Loud is pretty much a documentary about Jack White, The Edge from U2, and Jimmy Page from Yardbirds, and what's that other band? Led Zeppelin. Yeah, that's right. But enough about all that, my friends. We're here to basically pick up all the news we couldn't hit on yesterday's episode 167. And we're going to hit all three of my sites, cyberspacewar.com, foodworldorder.com. But first, we're going to hit mediamonarchy.com with drug wars, sterilization, scandals, and truth. And we're going to start off with an interesting and telling piece from the Skull and Bones started Time magazine. Don't let a pregnancy get in the way of your crack habit, or why drug addicts are getting sterilized for cash. When Joanne Chavarria's grandmother died last summer, she coped by turning to the bottle. I started to drink, and then I started to smoke some weed, and then I started doing meth, says the 32-year-old from Merced, California. So what's the gateway drug there? The liquor? Or was it death? Continuing, Chavarria, who began abusing drugs at the age of 12, was 8 months pregnant at the time. Last August, she gave birth to two drug-addicted twins, and California's Child Protective Services took the infants as well as Chavarria's three other children into custody. As with other addicts, the road to recovery for Chavarria began with counseling and a drug rehabilitation program. Less orthodox, however, was her decision to undergo a tubal ligation. Addicts in my situation need to get their tubes tied, she says. When you stop having kids, it makes you think about what else you can do in your life. Chavarria had the procedure done after meeting with Project Prevention, a North Carolina-based charity that gives drug addicts $300 if they go on long-term birth control or undergo sterilization. The aim of Barbara Harris, 57, the organization's controversial founder, is to prevent addicts from having children they can't care for and reduce the number of babies who are born exposed to drugs. And yes, there are good things within that, but of course this all ties in with essentially eugenics, and I haven't had time to investigate their controversial founder or Project Prevention, but as you should be well aware, eugenics, Margaret Sanger, Planned Parenthood, the Nazis, all of it is racist inherently in origin, and that's the one main thing that they hide from you. The Never-Ending Drug War is a new great piece over on globalresearch.ca. The personalities, politics, and espionage intrigues that shaped the DEA. Of course, the Drug Enforcement Agency being big fans of MediaMonarchy.com, visiting all the time. But our next story from the Associated Press. San Francisco Crime Lab at Center of Growing Scandal. The tape recorder started rolling as two police investigators sat in their car in a hospital parking lot with Deborah Madden on February 26th. "You're causing a huge nightmare for the city," said one officer. Now, the 60-year-old technician and the obscure police crime lab where she worked for 29 years stand at the center of a scandal that has led to the dismissal of hundreds of criminal cases and jeopardized thousands more. Police have accused Deborah Madden of skimming cocaine evidence from the lab, but she hadn't been criminally charged in the case. Forensics experts say Madden is not the first crime lab worker suspected of stealing drugs or other illegalities, and San Francisco's lab joined several other cities in suffering a loss of credibility. A Houston man was awarded $5 million last year after spending 17 years in prison on rape charges overturned because of a discredited criminal lab. Detroit shut down its crime lab in 2008 after outside auditors uncovered serious errors in the way evidence was handled, which I believe is probably their way of saying they're stealing drugs, tying into the fraudulent drug war that, of course, you see corrupt people, or at least people get into situations and let themselves be corrupted in this whole world of police and the drug war and the labs. But from News Junkie Post, and they've been doing a lot of good work on the crumbling marijuana war, let's tell the truth about marijuana. What would happen if, starting April 20th, so of course this is going back several days on MediaMonarchy.com, like I said, we can't fit in everything into the two-hour live show on Friday mornings. What would happen if, starting on April 20th, we all resolve not to settle for myths and lies and superstitions anymore when it comes to the most popular illegal plant in the world? After 72 years of the debate being controlled by those who've made it taboo to even talk honestly on the subject, it's time to tell the truth about marijuana. At the moment, the deck remains stacked, of course, in favor of cannabis prohibition. The reason? Folks who know that marijuana should be legal are too often too intimidated to say so, because speaking cannabis truth has sometimes carried a heavy price. For years, a few brave medical doctors, such as Lester Grinspoon of Harvard, have been voices in the wilderness of marijuana prohibition. Their repeated calls for an open and honest debate on the subject have largely fallen on deaf ears. Until now, when it comes to marijuana, those who know won't say, and those who say don't know. We have one last update posted at the bottom of this Drug Wars, Sterilization, Scandals, and Truth posting on MediaMonarchy.com. It's an article from Counterpunch, and it's written by Julian Marisail, another drug record for Afghanistan. In addition to being the world's leading producer of opium, Afghanistan has now become the largest producer of hashish, according to the first ever cannabis survey released by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime earlier in the month. Again, the U.S. invasion is behind the new record. If you look at the charts, and again, this article is long, I'm just giving you the intro, you see that the Taliban actually burned out their drug fields. And then the war was started, and then it's been increasing every year since. War is pretty much always based on deception. And a lot of the times, unfortunately, at least in modern warfare, if it's not just a resource war, it's basically, they're there for the drugs. The drugs fund the Wall Street operations and fund the military operations around the world. We're going to shift gears now and hop over to foodworldorder.com for a few posts. The first being the ugly list of headlines: the 422 binge and purge, pink wash, raw milk, and meat residues. That all sounds very, very yummy. Racing from the cure, Komen makes a mockery of themselves with their new Kentucky Fried Chicken pink wash campaign. This is one you have to see it to believe it, but let's listen to the commercial.
For Carol.
For my wife.
For my mom.
For every pink bucket of grilled or original recipe, KFC makes a 50-cent contribution to Susan G. Komen for the cure. Together, we could make the largest donation in Komen history to help end breast cancer forever.
Susan G. Komen for the cure has now crossed the line into asinine idiocy thanks to its new alliance with Kentucky Fried Chicken. That's right, kids. KFC was originally Kentucky Fried Chicken. But now it's none of those things. Where pink buckets of fried chicken are sold under the slogan, Buckets for the Cure. And we are not, again, making this up. The idea that buying fried chicken is actually going to cure cancer is one of the most utterly idiotic health ideas yet seen in American pop culture. Komen for the Cure is so far gone from reality that the organization doesn't even think twice about suggesting such an absurd idea. Eating fried chicken, folks, and then what? Loading up on that kind of diet is more likely to cause you to kick the bucket than to find a cure for cancer. Fried chicken, you see, is coated in starches. The recipe for KFC chicken batter is basically flour, sugar, salt, black pepper, and monosodium glutamate, MSG. All by itself, this is a recipe for chronic degenerative disease because the flour and sugar are highly processed, and the MSG is an excitotoxin that folks like Dr. Russell Blaylock links to obesity, cancer, and neurological disorders. And the meat itself, well, that's a whole other cruel story on top of that. So when you fry starches at high temperatures, you also create acrylamides, toxic chemical byproducts of cooking that are believed by many health experts to promote cancer. One scientific study, for example, demonstrated that eating acrylamides boosts kidney cancer rates by 59%. Acrylamides are also linked to ovarian cancer. So, now we got Susan G. Komen for the Cure actually promoting foods that promote cancer. It just boggles the mind, but it's entirely consistent with what we've said, and we're reading from naturalnews.com what they've said about Komen for the Cure in the past. The organization is a drug company-funded front group that actually promotes cancer, in Natural News' opinion, seeing it engaged in outright fraud by scamming consumers out of their money while claiming to be searching for the cure, when in reality, most of the money raised by the group actually goes to pay for more mammograms that cause cancer. Returning to the ugly list, FarmWars.info going into some of the latest fake food safety bills, feeding America poison one law at a time. U.S. government continues its war on raw milk. This is something that seems to be rising and rising. And again, in my work, I hear it pop up quite frequently. Growing awareness among the American populace about the health benefits of wholesome raw milk has been steadily increasing over the past decade, putting many state and federal officials into a frenzy. The harsh crackdown tactics used in the past to deter farmers from selling and consumers from buying raw milk are giving way to a new approach that anti-raw milk fanatics hope will put an end to the sale of raw milk. Stopping people from consuming raw milk is a top priority for federal and state officials. While millions of Americans are seriously injured by or die from pharmaceutical drugs every year, U.S. regulatory agencies are busy devising new ways to prevent family farmers from selling a natural, health-promoting food to their citizens. Despite hordes of evidence to the contrary, officials continue to repeat mindless mantras about the dangers of raw milk in an effort to steer people back to the cooked and crushed milk products sold on store shelves. When that fails, they just resort to guerrilla-style terrorist tactics instead. For years, these rogue agencies, which include the Departments of Agriculture and the FDA, have raided raw dairies, assaulted farmers, and terrorized families. This article is, again, from naturalnews.com, and they go on to cite some of the raid cases. But let's hurry up and finish this binge and purge. Winco expands fresh beef recall. ABC kind of grilled Monsanto's own Vilsack, of course appointed by Obama, on an interview about meat residues. Wholesale prices rise most in 26 years as food costs explode. That should probably have been at the top of the list. That's an AP article. An interesting one. Always great stuff from allgov.com. Retired generals and admirals say junk food at schools threatens U.S. security, or too fat to fight. And again, we only care about you as long as we can get you into the machine, into the war machine, and grind you out and spit you out. Glass in water hoax gets a Washington state woman some jail time. And lastly, groups express concern over GMO labeling ahead of a May conference in Canada. There will be a conference coming up. This story from foodsafetynews.com. More than 80 public health, environmental, agriculture, and organic food organizations are fighting to protect GM, or genetically modified, or GE, genetically engineered, food labels. The group sent a letter last Tuesday to Michael Taylor, Deputy Commissioner for Food at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Does that name sound familiar? Oh, that's right. That's another guy from Monsanto that Obama has appointed to oversee food safety. You smell that change? So perhaps we'll return to this as we get to the United Nations Codex Committee on Food Labeling meeting in Quebec City in early May to discuss the labeling issue. That definitely is something we should return to, and it will be early May very soon, my friends. Up next on Food World Order, there have been a lot of great, basically, food truth documentaries. Some okay, some fantastic. We've got the trailer for another entry into the Water Wars documentary, Tapped, the movie. A look at the big business of bottled water. This article from Food Freedom, when we actually preface this and tie it in, let's go ahead and hit this first. Not exactly related, but it all relates. Plastic soup found in Atlantic Ocean. Researchers are warning of a new blight on the ocean, a swirl of confetti-like plastic debris stretching over thousands of square miles in a remote expanse of the Atlantic Ocean. The floating garbage, plastic islands at sea, if you will, hard to spot from the surface and spun together by a vortex of currents, was documented by two groups of scientists who trawled the sea between scenic Bermuda and Portugal's mid-Atlantic Azores Islands. The studies describe a soup of microparticles similar to the so-called Great Pacific Garbage Patch, a phenomenon discovered a decade ago between Hawaii and California that researchers say is likely to exist in other places around the globe. So that's plastic soup found in Atlantic Ocean, but now returning to Tapped, the movie, examining the role of the bottled water industry and its effects on health, climate change, pollution, and reliance on oil. Anytime you drink bottled water, not only are you putting your health at risk, you're also contributing to one of the most massive environmental waste nightmares of all time. There's a simple, safe, green solution. The next time somebody offers you a plastic bottle of water, take a stand and say something clever like, "No thanks, I don't believe in it."
As Mark Twain once said, you know, whiskey is for sipping and water is for fighting. And there's going to be a lot of fighting about this before it's done.
When you think about the finished product of a plastic bottle, you don't think about the process.
Most of the public does not know that their plastic materials are being made in petrochemical plants.
People think when they're drinking bottled water that they're getting a healthy product. They're not conditioned to think, well, maybe there's something in the plastic.
Found that one person at the FDA was responsible for overseeing all of the regulation of bottled water in the country.
Are you that one person?
I do spend some of my time on bottled water, but I have other responsibilities as well.
We don't consider tap water to be an enemy. We don't.
Can people typically perceive a difference in taste?
I can tell the difference in many bottled waters, just as I can tell the difference between tap water and other beverages.
You can.
Absolutely.
You know, you're under oath, but you're...
Absolutely.
We'll give you,
I say that with...
We'll give you a tongue exemption.
Well, first of all, we should realize that a lot of bottled water is tap water.
You, what do you mean? I thought that they came from, like, the mountains and the streams and the springs of Maine.
That's what they would have us believe.
Bottled water is the greatest advertising and marketing trick of all time.
There are all sorts of ecological problems. We use approximately 18 million barrels of oil to transport water, and it's growing every year.
It's as if we're a bulimic society. We've been binging on petroleum. We've been packaging everything in plastic. And now we're running out of resources.
In a time when we're looking at climate change, why are we shipping water around the world?
If you eliminate the scourge of bottled water, you'll be eliminating one of the biggest problems facing our environment.
In the fake life.
There's plastic everywhere in the ocean. There's 9 million football fields of area. About as big as Texas, 3.5 million tons of plastic out there, all absorbing pollutants, animals consuming it up the food chain to the food that you and I eat.
We want to drink the purest water that we can get. Now, why would you put that water into a substance which has the potential to leach chemicals into that water?
10 brands that we tested contained everything from radioactive materials to arsenic and industrial solvents, chemicals that leach out of the plastic itself.
You're talking about virtually no testing, and people have just assumed that what we're getting is safe.
Something causes a lot of these neighbors around here to be sick.
When people buy bottled water, they are contributing to the toxic exposures that people here are suffering with.
We don't have a chance. We do not have a possible chance.
And one day we'll see the light.
Bisphenol A may be one of the most potent toxic chemicals known to man.
We don't have BPA in our product.
None of your products?
Correct.
What about the 5-gallon jugs?
I'm not sure about those.
Bisphenol A is an industrial chemical that's in a big 5-gallon jug.
My concern is that the FDA doesn't want us to ask about BPA because of the current
that's
investigation.
Not true.
Can you talk about it now?
Yeah. If I had known you were going to talk about that, probably wouldn't have given you the interview.
What's happening here in Freiburg is really a microcosm for what's happening all around the world.
Nestle, in the 10 years that they have been operating in this community, has torn the fabulous community apart.
It's all about the control and ownership of water. It is not something where you can just sit back and hope that your elected representatives will always do the right thing.
When we drink bottled water, we're telling our leaders that we don't care about the system.
Well, this government's not doing anything. I mean, this government's for sale. And so everything's ready to be auctioned off, including the public's right to water. Water is a basic human right.
Everybody drinks water every day.
It's necessary for the survival of life on the planet. The whole place is corrupt when you start modifying the necessities of life in such a way as to make it more difficult for people to gain access to those necessities. You have the basis for serious political instability.
We are the children of Revolutionary War soldiers, and we are not going to give this up without a fight.
We won't let corporations come into our community, take our water.
We are not giving it up without a fight.
Water is really the next empire.
We've got a lot of water war flashbacks from foodworldorder.com. Fiji water, spin the bottle, the politics of water. That goes back to August of last year. Millions in U.S. drink dirty water records show, and bottled water sales leaking, but tap water increasingly unsafe. Another entry, probably, in that water wars campaign. Dow Chemical pretends to care about water scarcity. This from News Junkie Post in what amounts to an incredible hypocrisy. The Dow Chemical Company is sponsoring Run for Water events held across the globe. The events organized by the environmental organization Live Earth are taking place April 18th, so they did, and are supposed to raise global awareness about water scarcity. The Dow Chemical Company can't run from its responsibility for the ongoing impacts of the 1984 Bhopal gas leak by sponsoring Live Earth Run for Water events, said Amnesty International. Of course, in Bhopal, central India, thousands of people died and more than 100,000 continue to suffer from serious health problems as consequences of a 1984 deadly leak of toxic chemicals from a Union Carbide pesticide plant. In 2001, Dow assumed 100% ownership of Union Carbide. Since 2001, survivors and many human rights organizations, with Amnesty International in the forefront, have campaigned for Dow to assume its responsibility and address the ongoing impact of the disaster, including the contamination of water by chemical waste. However, Dow is still denying responsibility in Bhopal. Shortly before midnight on December 2, 1984, thousands of pounds of deadly chemicals leaked from the Union Carbide pesticide plant in Bhopal. Around 500,000 people were exposed. Between 7 and 10,000 died in the immediate aftermath, and a further 15,000 died over the next 20 years. Now, more than 25 years later, the site hasn't been cleaned up. The leak and its impact have not been properly investigated, and more than 100,000 people continue to suffer from serious health problems without getting proper medical care or compensation. For more than 25 years, both the government of India and Dow have failed to address the human rights abuses that have been the lasting legacy of Bhopal. Sponsoring an event that highlights water scarcity while ignoring ongoing problems with access to clean water and medical care, amongst tons of other issues, in Bhopal is at best hypocrisy, at worst a flagrant attempt by Dow Chemical to try to whitewash its image. Dow may be behind its sponsorship of Run for Water events. Bhopal raises fundamental questions about the accountability of corporations and the capacity and willingness of governments to address corporate-related human rights abuses. Further, Dow's sponsorship of the Run for Water events poses a serious risk to the credibility of Live Earth. On March 26th, Amnesty International wrote to Live Earth to express their concerns about Dow's involvement in Run for Water, but Live Earth did not respond. News Junkie Post does good work. I believe they totally still are kind of the true believers in anthropogenic global warming and the climate control, if you will. But, of course, we know how this can happen. It's because the corporations have people appointed in the cabinet. You know, just like we discussed with Monsanto and the current puppet administration. In the previous, we had Donald Rumsfeld getting aspartame and all the other things approved in his revolving door with the pharmaceutical industries, Tom Daschle, all these guys. And this is how it goes on and on and on. Would you like an update for this so we can thoroughly put this to bed? Al Gore takes cash for water campaign from Dow Chemical. So now we also have Al Gore involved and Live Earth involved. Live Earth, of course, being helped and fronted by one of the Rothschild kids. He's the hot kind of international jet-setting yuppie, enviro, hippie guy that, of course, lots of fools will follow that attractive bloodline. They'll follow him off the cliff. Let's now hop to cyberspacewar.com for an update on a story that I'm glad has not gone away. And this is one that has captured a lot of people, and they know this is one of those stories that makes the average person who maybe doesn't pay attention to all the alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups going on every day in front of their damn face. Webcam gate expands as lawyers say thousands of pictures taken. School secretly snapped thousands of students at home. We're getting this from Threat Level. And of course, our story goes back to February on cyberspacewar.com. School spied on kids via webcams. A webcam spying scandal at a suburban Philadelphia school district is broadening, with lawyers claiming the district secretly snapped thousands of webcam images of students using school-issued laptops without the pupils' knowledge or consent. Some of the images included pictures of youths at home, in bed, or even partially dressed, according to a Thursday filing in the case. Pupils' online chats were also captured, as well as a record of the websites they visit. When the story first broke in February, the school district said the cameras were activated only a handful of times when a laptop was reported stolen or missing, an assertion lawyers suing the district say is false. Quote, discovery today has now revealed that thousands of webcam pictures and screenshots have been taken from numerous other students in their homes, many of which never reported their laptops lost or missing, according to Mark Haltzman, attorney, writing in a filing for federal court, and we have the PDF download for you. In February, the Lower Merion School District in suburban Philadelphia in Pennsylvania in the United States of America with a K, the Lower Merion School District deactivated the webcam tracking program secretly lodged on 2,300 student laptops. Thursday's filing, which claims 400 images of Robbins, this would be Blake Robbins, this would be the kid and the family that broke this story, and along with this posting, we have a picture that the Robbins family has released that shows the kid fucking sleeping. And I believe some of the reporting, and again, we have all the contextual, subtextual links to flesh out this story for you. I believe there are reports of some of the teachers even getting into it and treating it like it's a reality show. Like, oh, God, let's see, you know, well, what's that silly Blake going to do? Thursday's filing, which claims 400 images of Blake Robbins were taken during a two-week period last fall, also says that an IT administrator at the district may be a voyeur. Lawyers suing the district are urging a federal judge presiding over the case to grant a forensic examination of administrator's personal computer. The lawsuit said the administrator, who had been placed on paid leave, invokes the Fifth Amendment to every question asked of her, including a question asked to whether she had ever downloaded pictures to her own computer, including pictures of students who were naked while in their home. They pled the Fifth. The lawsuit seeks class action status to represent all the district's 2,300 high school students. Proposed legislation announced late Thursday by Senator Arlen Single Bullet defended Ira Einhorn, the unicorn killer specter of Pennsylvania, would make it a federal felony to remotely spy on private residences and hotel rooms with video cameras. That story kind of should make you ill. And it gets worse and worse as we expand into the national security state. Of course, all thanks to the National Security Act of 1947. This next piece comes from Tom Burkhart of Anti-Fascist Calling, and it's also up as an exclusive on the fantastic blacklistednews.com. Pentagon's Cybercom says civilian infrastructure a legitimate target. This goes into some of the deep stuff going on with CyberCom and StratCom, and this concerns memos from Robert Gates. And it's basically, as we've noted, according to what's now kind of old, the Information Operations Roadmap about the military fighting the net as if it were an enemy weapon system. Here they're now saying essentially that civilian infrastructure is a legitimate target in the coming cyber war. Meaning, if they have to hack and damage and either literally, figuratively blow up your cyber shit, they're going to do it. Now, for a story we did cover on the latest New World Next Week with CorbettReport.com, Yahoo beats feds in email privacy case. This again from Threat Level on Wired. Yahoo prevailed last Friday over Colorado federal prosecutors in a legal battle testing whether the Constitution's warrant requirements apply to Americans' emails. Saying a contested email would not be helpful to the government's investigation, authorities withdrew demands for email in a pending and sealed criminal case. For the moment, the move ends litigation over the hotly contested issue of whether a warrant under the Fourth Amendment is required for Yahoo and other email providers to release consumer communications to the authorities. This brouhaha concerned a 1986 law that already allowed the government to obtain a suspect's email from an internet service provider or webmail provider without a probable cause warrant once it's been stored for 180 days or more. The government contended and then backed off in this Friday ruling, Yahoo beating the feds in email privacy battle. The government contended and backed off Friday that it could get email less than 180 days old if that email has been read by the owner and that the Constitution's Fourth Amendment protections don't apply. Yahoo was backed up, and we have, again, PDF downloads from the government's position and Yahoo being backed up and the briefs and all of that. Yahoo was backed by EFF.org, Electronic Frontier Foundation, and James Corbett did have an interview recently with Rebecca Jeske of EFF.org. Yahoo is backed by EFF, Google, and the Center for Democracy and Technology in challenging the government's position. It defied a court order to turn over those emails to the feds in a Colorado criminal probe that is under seal. Litigation over the topic ensued, and the government blinked in a legal standoff highlighting antiquated privacy laws. Had the courts adopted the government's position, the vast majority of Americans' emails would be accessible to the government without probable cause whenever law enforcement believed the messages would be relevant to criminal investigation, even if the email's owner was not suspected of wrongdoing. Still, the government's move does not resolve the privacy issue, but merely instead delays it for a later day. This connects, I think, quite intimately to the story that we covered again on cyberspacewar.com just earlier in the month and earlier on a New World Next Week episode. FCC lost their net neutrality battle against Comcast. Issues, my friends, far too deep to get into right now. Our last posting on cyberspacewar.com is an ugly list of headlines. DEFCON 422, takedowns, lockups, and predictive analytics. Google exposes government takedown requests. Let's hop over to PCMag.com for this. Google has added a tool to provide a bit more transparency into the number of government requests it receives to remove or otherwise filter content. And you can hit this at google.com/government requests. The government request tool is rather sparse at the moment. It merely shows the number of requests it's received from each country and the types of the content it has been asked to remove. There are no further descriptions of the removed content. Let's hit this link and look at it right now. Government requests directed to Google and YouTube, and it has the countries by the most requests: Brazil, Germany, India, the United States, and South Korea being the top five. And these are only listed for July 1st to December 31st, 2009, so that six-month period. And again, it just basically gives you an overlay over your standard Google Maps map field. Google.com/government requests. And to give you the number, U.S. demanded user info 3,500 times in 6 months. More on that from Threat Level. and more about Google and, of course, this hack attack that we had at the end of 2009. Now reports saying Google hackers stole source code of a global password system belonging to Google. And we don't have time to get into all of the intelligence connections, and this really is going to be the cyberspace war, my friends. Second banker accused of stealing high-frequency trading code. So now you tie in the banksters to the cyberspace war, and it really starts to get interesting. That is also coming from Threat Level. An amazing story earlier in the week. McAfee's antivirus program locked up millions of PCs worldwide. We've just got one report from ABC News, and of course there were lots of updates, and it apparently worked itself out, and McAfee apologized, and yada yada. Crime prediction software is here, and as Gizmodo.com points out, it's a very bad idea. InfoWars also has the press release and more on pre-crime going down in Florida. IBM's predictive analytics, and again, these are the same organizations, the same families that have been working on their world domination agenda, as cartoonish and action movie as though that may sound. Yes, Virginia, there really are multi-generational serial killer families and corporations and secret societies that tell you to live like there's no tomorrow, but have been crafting their plan to depopulate and gain ultimate power for themselves. Yes. And IBM is integral part of that. Online game shoppers duped into selling their souls. Microsoft's Chinese labor scandal. More trouble ahead for the rest of high tech. That's from bnet.com. An interesting article from Media Commons. Futureofthebook.org. Cultivated play on Farmville. Now, anyone who spends any amount of time on FBook knows that Farmville is one of those popular little games that everybody plays. This article, which is too long to get into, but a fascinating one that just kind of breaks down the kind of social and psychological effects of playing this farm game constantly on Facebook and all the ramifications of that. 9-year-old blamed for U.S. school system hacked. A third of U.S. teens with phones text 100 times a day. WikiLeaks claims Facebook deleted its page with 30,000 fans, and then I think they said, oh, whoops, and put it back the next day, or a few days later, rather. We've got a leak of a draft of the secretive international copyright treaty, and of course, confirms all our fears about the coming loss of net freedoms. More on that from alternet.org. Reverse engineering artist busts biometric control grid. This is a good one. Let's hit this from theregister.co.uk. Concern about the proliferation of face recognition systems in public places. That's called biometrics. A grad student in New York is developing privacy-enhancing hacks designed to thwart the futuristic surveillance technology. Using off-the-shelf makeup and accessories such as glasses, veils, and artificial hair, Adam Harvey's master's thesis combines hipster fashion aesthetics with hardcore reverse engineering of face detection software. The goal? To give individuals a low-cost and visually stimulating means to prevent their likenesses from being detected and cataloged by face recognition monitors. The number of sensors that are going into public spaces has been increasing, said Harvey, a student at New York University's Interactive Telecommunications Program. There's a lot of work to be done to catch up to where cameras are going because there have been so many advances in the last few years. Although still in its adolescence, I believe it's in its adolescence of them completely rolling it out and getting us in the system, but it's there. Face recognition technology is quickly being adopted by governments and corporations to identify individuals whose images are captured by surveillance cameras. At the 2001 Super Bowl, for instance, officials digitized the faces of everyone entering Raymond James Stadium in Tampa, Florida, and compared the results against photographic lists of known malefactors. In another example, the city of Chicago, of course, now the most surveilled city in the United States of America with a K. Chicago, 2 years ago, made much fanfare of their Operation Virtual Shield, which, of course, we covered for you on MediaMonarchy.com, which was to use IBM software to analyze in real time thousands of hours of video being recorded on more than 1,000 continuously running cameras. As a starting point, Harvey's research involves the reverse engineering of OpenCV, which its creators describe as an open-source library of programming functions for real-time computer vision. From that work, he developed an understanding of the algorithm used to tell if an image captured by a camera is, say, a car, a building, or a human face. Based on the so-called Viola Jones method, with a PDF for you, the algorithm examines the spatial relationships of an object captured in an image and looks for features commonly found in faces. Most faces have a dark region just above the eyes, while the cheekbone and nose bridge will appear lighter. When the algorithm detects enough such attributes, it guesses the object is a face. The method is generally regarded as effective. Errors are in favor of false positives, making it hard for unobstructed faces to escape notice when they aren't captured at an angle. Once a face is detected, other technologies such as face recognition can be used to compare the face against a database in an attempt to identify the person it belongs to. But Harvey has discovered that face detection can often be thrown off by using makeup to alter the contrasts the technology looks for. For example, dark patterns applied around eyes and cheekbones, as in the image provided here on register.co.uk. For example, dark patterns applied around eyes and cheekbones, as in the image below, are one such possibility. And they aren't so bad. You could kind of look like you're either in Kiss or football player or something. There's a lot of trial and error, Harvey said. The common thread is throwing off the symmetry the algorithm looks for. It's a lot more difficult than applying a bunch of makeup and hoping it works, or putting on your 3D glasses left over from Avatar. Ha ha. Fantastic work, though. Bravo, Adam Harvey, and your master's thesis at NYU. Reverse engineering artist busting biometrics. The last few headlines on this DEFCON 422 takedowns, lockups, and predictive analytics. Second Life players sue over the illegal seizure of virtual property. That's from allgov.com, but I believe we already noted civilian infrastructure is a legitimate target in the coming cyberspace war. And now it all starts to tie together, my friends. Richard Clark, Mr. Your government failed you. The nation's first special advisor to the president for cybersecurity and author of the new book, Cyber War, The Next Threat to National Security and What to Do About It. Of course, talks with, as my man James Corbett put her, the nauseating creature Rachel Maddow, talking about America's vulnerability to online attacks. And we have this clip from Raw Story and Raw Replay, but let's give it a little bit more of an intro. We got a piece, well, this is also from Raw Story, but it's posted up on InfoWars. Richard Clark, who was the United States' first special advisor to the president for cybersecurity during the Bush administration, believes that cyber war is a very real threat to the United States. He fears, however, that an aversion to government regulation is standing in the way of protecting vital systems. Regulation is a dirty word, Clark told MSNBC's Rachel Maddow. Industries resist. The government cannot defend cyberspace under existing law. Clark feels that more surveillance of the internet is necessary, but he also believes that telephone companies and ISPs rather than the government need to be the ones filtering for code which indicates attack software. I'm not going to be the guy who says trust the government, he emphasized. Oh, Jesus, we're going to listen to this clip. But, of course, Richard Clark, as well as Lawrence Lessig, have both admitted there is an iPatriot Act sitting on the shelf waiting for an I-9-11, a catalyzing, catastrophic event that will most likely be pulled off by the rogue network in the cyberspace war that are connected to all massive terror attacks in the world that ultimately lead back again to the rogue network, the Patsies, the Intel Agency, CIA, MI5, Mossad, ISI. And of course, we know the phone companies and the ISPs are already doing it anyway. Again, this is, if you've studied it just a little bit, you start to see the ridiculous nature of all of this. But they have to keep coming out and telling you these things to... It's predictive programming. It's predictive analytics, my friends. So let's just get it over with and listen to Richard, your government killed you, Clark, and Microsoft, General Electric, Maddow.
We believe that lovable rogues in baseball hats in our heist movies can take down critical infrastructure through hacking. Why do we have such a hard time believing the Chinese intelligence services might do it to us too? Joining us now is Richard Clark. He was the nation's first special advisor to the president for cybersecurity. He's also the government's former counterterrorism chief. He's now chairman of Good Harbor Consulting. His new book is called Cyber War, The Next Threat to National Security and What to Do About It. Richard Clark, thank you so much for being here.
I'm delighted to be here.
So I read the book and I'm sort of obsessed with the concepts in it, as you might be able to tell.
I can see that.
That last 4th of July attack, I remember it as affecting websites of like the FTC, Treasury Department. It was sort of seen mostly as a nuisance. How bad could that have been?
Well, the North Korean attack, and it was a North Korean attack, is interesting because there's nothing for us to attack back in retaliation. They don't have cyberspace very much over there. In fact, they had to launch the attack from China and from South Korea.
So they have North Korean operatives outside, physically outside of North Korea in places with better internet infrastructures from which they can launch attacks.
Oh, absolutely. They had North Korean army people take over a whole floor of a hotel in China to launch part of this attack. So that's interesting. They can defend themselves because they don't have anything to defend in cyberspace. And even this poor little country can attack us. What they didn't do, they flooded us in various sites. What they didn't do was get inside those sites. But they could, or somebody else could. We know that countries can get inside the control systems for the things you mentioned. The electric power grid. So they turn off the lights? No, they don't just turn off the lights. They cause a generator to explode. That's hard to replace. It keeps the electric power grid down for a long time. They could cause trains to derail. So the United States government has created these military commands, the 10th Fleet, which has no ships, the 24th Air Force, which has no planes, U.S. Cyber Command, to do this sort of thing. China's created military commands. Russia's created military commands. So for me, there are two takeaways here. One, we better defend ourselves, and we're not doing that. Unfortunately, the Obama administration's attitude is, we'll defend the government, the rest of you are on your own. And the other takeaway here is, we don't talk about arms control. We ought to try to get this military under control. We need some civilian oversight of this thing before it happens by accident.
When you talk about our military cyber command, is it offense or defense or both?
It's
sounds
both.
Like it's... Okay.
It's both.
So it's about finding ways to access other countries' vulnerabilities, not accessible through physical warfare, but through computing.
Right.
But it's also trying to protect the United States from similar attacks.
It's trying to protect the Pentagon from similar attacks. It doesn't have the authority and it doesn't have the capability to defend you and me, to defend the banking system, to defend the power grid, trains, pipelines. No one's doing that. The government's policy is you defend yourself. It's as though in the Cold War, when the Russians had bombers that could come bomb us, it's as though the government said to U.S. Steel in Pittsburgh, you know, the Russians have bombers. You better get some air defense systems to protect yourself from them.
Right. Because we don't want to interfere with your private industry. Yeah.
Right. It goes back to ideology, and it goes back to the dislike in Washington to regulation. I mean, the only way the government's going to be able to defend our cyberspace is to have more regulation. That regulation in Washington is a dirty word. But if we don't have some targeted regulation, we're not going to be able to defend ourselves against North Korea or Iran. If we do sanctions on Iran over their nuclear program and they choose to retaliate by a cyber attack and we're defenseless, you know, the day after, people are going to wake up and say, why couldn't we defend ourselves?
Critical national systems that are not government systems are the sort of things that we thought about in terms of traditional counterterrorism measures. Things like chemical plant security, things like the security of our ports, other things that are not necessarily government functions but we recognize would be an attack on the American people. We've also been not very successful at making ourselves more resilient in those senses because we've had to go through industry in order to try to get those things protected. Right. Same thing's happening here.
Same thing's happening here. Regulation is a dirty word. Industries resist. We just had Verizon win the case in federal court, and the federal judge ruled the government cannot regulate the internet under existing law. Well, then the government cannot defend cyberspace under existing law.
Is there a conflict between privacy concerns on the internet and the need to protect from our critical national systems from cyber attack?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Now, one simple way, and it would be a terrible idea, but one simple way to defend would be to have the government filtering, watching what's going on the internet. You know, after the Bush administration wireless wiretapping with NSA, I don't think that's a very good idea.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be the guy who says trust the government.
Yeah.
But there's a way of doing it by making the telephone companies, making the internet service providers filter what's going on their networks.
Can you filter for security but not for content?
Yeah, you can't. What you do is you look for patterns of ones and zeros that are known to be attack software. And you're not reading people's emails. But even then, I don't want the government doing it.
Yeah.
Let's have Verizon do it. Let's have AT&T do it. And let's have somebody else checking to make sure they're not abusing our privacy rights.
One last question for you. Is this going to be another one of these post-Cold War things that's sort of defined both by asymmetry and anonymity, where countries, nation states are at a disadvantage, and the real threats, the real agility, the real incentive to use attacks like this are for non-state terrorist groups and for lone wolves or extremists?
No, I know there's a theory out there that that's the case. I think this is about nation states. And that's, in fact, good news.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we get our act together, we can move from talking about cyber war to talking about cyber peace.
I'd like us to be talking about cyber defense first.
Well, that's part of cyber peace.
Yeah. Cyber War, The Next Threat to National Security and What to Do About It is the new book by Richard Clark. It's not only important, it's compelling and written like a thriller, which is one of your particular skills, sir. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right. So to finally fully drive the point home of the cyber space war, our last article comes by way of VentureBeat.com, but we're going to get it bookended from Cryptogon.com. Facebook steps up lobbying, deepens ties with intelligence agencies. And Cryptogon intros the news story from VentureBeat with a flashback of his own, noting in a one sentence guess about what this is all actually about. Facebook is a CIA cutout that's frantically lobbying for privacy legislation to remain lax so that it can continue to run its various intelligence operations on the Facebook platform. The VentureBeat article notes, Facebook has been gradually boosting its profile in Washington, D.C. over the past year and is on the hunt for a second senior lobbyist to add to its office of four. Disclosures released a few days ago show that on top of lobbying the usual suspects internet companies reach out to, like the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and the U.S. senators and representatives, the fast-growing social network has also been busy deepening its ties to government intelligence and homeland security agencies. What's interesting about Facebook's lobbying is in D.C. is what it spends its money on despite its small size. It was the only consumer internet company out of Google, Amazon, eBay, Microsoft, Yahoo, and Apple to reach out to the intelligence agencies last year. It has lobbied the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, an umbrella office founded in the wake of 9/11 that synthesizes intelligence from 17 agencies, including the CIA, and advises the president. It's reached out to the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, too. My friends, that's pretty getting fairly high up on the pyramid of the national security state. That is, of course, a brick in the overall world control grid. That's all basically being set up. Jesus, what a depressing way to spend my Saturday night. That's going to do it for this B-side episode of 167 of MediaMonarchy.com. The way that we're going to go out here is something I didn't have time to play during yesterday's live episode, and that is how New York officials prepare for the threat of a dirty bomb. We're going to go out and listen to this audio piece that's very well done, very well produced, and it just has all the great talking points and all our favorite misleaders concerning the war of terror and the coming space war, the coming economic war, the class war, all of it. And, of course, ratcheting all of this up are the drills, of course, that we went over extensively on yesterday's show. So this, I think, is quite a good piece. It's kind of long. It's about 7 or 8 minutes, but that's how we're going to go out, my friends. And, yeah, that's... I don't know what else to say. I mean, I went to a panel discussion last night. I was invited by Jeff Simmons, who started Radio23.org, which provides the high-quality feeds of the Media Monarchy show, feeds.feedburner.com/Media Monarchy HD, and those are suitable for rebroadcast. And again, thanks to all our affiliates who play and replay Media Monarchy, especially those who play these B-side episodes. And it was with a lot of other folks. It was about the future of community radio in Portland specifically, and it had folks from terrestrial, internet, free, and corporate radio. So there were folks from KNRK here in Portland and KPSU and KBOO. And it was really interesting, and I know I was the only guy that did, of course, of alternative news and politics show, and I was the one at the roundtable saying, well, I'd like to think that if the internet disappeared tomorrow, we'd all still be getting together having a meeting about how we're going to set up an FM transmitter and do shortwave and AM and ham radio if we have to. And that's why we're doing all this. There is a cyberspace war coming. It may not be as easy to do what we've been doing for the last 5 years on Media Monarchy. I'm not a doom and gloomer, but it's a very real possibility, and that's, I think, why we try and work as consistently and efficiently as we can just to try and shake up and wake up folks out there about what is really going down. I don't have all the answers, but a little bit of investigation will show you that the shadows on the wall ain't real, my friends. So again, we're going to go out with how New York officials prepare for the threat of a dirty bomb from WNYC. And in this case, it's even more appropriate, my friends, to get active or get radioactive. My name's James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Take care.
It's a scenario that U.S. intelligence professionals have worried about for years. Terrorists acquire the material for an atomic bomb and detonate it in the United States.
Obviously, the likelihood of an atomic bomb is much less because the technology for a nuclear detonation is complicated and requires some special elements.
Michael Chertoff, the former Homeland Security Secretary, says assembling and deploying a so-called dirty bomb would be a lot easier for terrorists to pull off.
A radiological bomb is nothing more than radioactive material embedded in or wrapped around a conventional explosive. So that's a much easier type of device to construct and also to get the material for. So it's not a fanciful thing to focus on.
Since September 11th, Police Commissioner Ray Kelly has committed 1,000 officers to a global counterterrorism program that is closely integrated with what the federal government is doing. Kelly says that even though the dirty bomb is not an atomic blast, it could have major consequences.
What it can do, besides the damage of the conventional explosive effect, would be to prevent you from going into an area and making it a hot zone for conceivably a very long time. Years, perhaps, or even longer than that.
Former Homeland Security Secretary Chertoff says there is a base plan at the federal government to deal with a radiological emergency.
The real challenge is to drive that plan and that planning process into the state and local governments because they have to be full partners in this. Otherwise, you wind up in a Katrina situation where the local and the state authorities throw their hands up and all of a sudden it defaults to the federal government.
Easier said than done. Radiological emergencies present officials and first responders with unique challenges. Controversy still surrounds how the state and federal officials responded in 1979 to Three Mile Island. Richard Thornburgh was the governor of Pennsylvania at the time.
I am advising those who may be particularly susceptible to the effects of any radiation, that is, pregnant women, and preschool-aged children to leave the area within a 5-mile radius of the Three Mile Island facility until further notice. We've also ordered the closing of any schools within this area. I repeat that this and other contingency measures are based on my belief that an excess of caution is best.
When Three Mile Island occurred, nobody, including the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, had any concept whatsoever of how to bring it back into control.
Dr. Michael Edelstein is a social psychologist who teaches at New Jersey's Ramapo College. He spent the last 30 years traveling the world studying chemically and radiologically contaminated communities.
So there was a period of time in which neither the governor nor any spokesperson for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission or the government could say anything that was particularly cogent.
Edelstein says with no concrete grasp of how Three Mile Island would play out, Thornburg's move was prudent. He says while officials have to worry about not panicking the public, they can't be perceived as having a hidden agenda. Edelstein says the job for New York City's officials coping with a radiological attack will be complicated by public skepticism. He says the Environmental Protection Agency under the Bush administration hurt the government's credibility when it gave the all clear for the air quality around the World Trade Center after September 11th.
Trust is a major issue. When you're a citizen and you're put at risk in a situation like this, who are you going to look to but government? I mean, who else is in a position to help you? But in all the research I've done all these years, all too often when you look to government in these situations, you're disappointed at what you find.
In New York City, the public will be looking to the Office of Emergency Management. Kelly McKinney is responsible for helping draft OEM's response plan.
So you're setting up your incident command, you're defining the extent of the contaminated area, you're assisting people there, you're conducting life safety, you're doing decontamination operations, you're trying to monitor the levels of radiation.
McKinney says one of the biggest challenges for city planners is having to both inform the public about a specific emergency while at the same time educating them about an invisible threat they know little about.
Radiation is a risk that is perceived very differently by the public than it is by the experts.
It's not something that's taught in schools, and it's not something that gets a proper and objective view.
Lisa Gordon Haggerty is a health physicist and one of the nation's top experts on radiological event response. She has served in leadership posts at the U.S. Department of Energy and the National Security Council. She says it's hard to inform a public about relative risk if they don't know that radiation at background levels already occurs naturally, or that forms of radiation can be used to save lives.
More often than not, you hear people talking about the horrific effects of being exposed to radiation. Well, we live with it in our everyday lives, and we're exposed to it in the countless numbers of people that have been saved in from cancer treatments to other types of treatments involving radioactive materials.
Gordon Haggerty says without a basic understanding of radiation, the public will fall back on their survival instincts. This could have dire consequences for them and their families.
When being exposed to radiation, we have the desire as humans to flee a location. Sometimes sheltering in place is the best way of minimizing exposure. So staying in the house, closing off ventilation systems and things like that often is the most suitable way of protecting yourself.
All right, guys, thanks for showing up today. We're going to do a radiation choke point and spot dive.
Out on the Hudson on an NYPD patrol boat north of the George Washington Bridge, Lieutenant Nelson and his crew are working to try to make sure the region does not get hit by a radiological attack. Nelson has a packed agenda. He's leading a regional drill to check for vessels that might be carrying radioactive material. He's also going to test some new Coast Guard radios.
We're going to set up north of the Harlem River. We're going to screen any recreational small vessels coming through for radiological devices on board.
Ironically, heavily enriched uranium, the most dangerous atomic bomb fuel, cannot be reliably detected by existing technology. But Nelson says radioactive materials that can be used for a so-called dirty bomb are detectable. He says getting a false hit on his equipment is pretty common.
It does happen, and again, you want to check out the source. Sometimes you get medicinal sources. I mean, there's legit reasons for people to have radiological materials. I've had instances where people have pulled over 5, 6, 7 times, saying, they got the paperwork from the doctor, saying, yeah, just had a stress test done or whatnot.
Budget cuts on the state and city level are threatening to reduce the region's emergency response capability. New York Senator Chuck Schumer says more financial support from the federal government is needed in light of President Obama's change in policy.
So the experts have now said a dirty bomb is one of the most serious dangers we face. At the same time, you have billions wasted on still fighting as if, you know, the Soviet Union were our number one menace.
After decades of the Cold War, it will take the Obama administration time to reorient the entire federal security apparatus. Right now, for New Yorkers concerned about preparedness, the Office of Emergency Management says the first best step is to sign up with its Notify NYC Emergency Alert System. It updates households by cell phone, landline, by text message or email about everything from water main breaks to terrorist attacks in your zip code. For WNYC, I'm Bob Henley.
How would you explain it?
Combining music and stylized images.
I mean, so it's all remote control.
Each one of those images was electronically based.
Say out on my threat.
And that concludes our program for tonight.
This could really catch on.
I can't remember when I've been so moved.